Well, Sabbath blessings to everybody. We're all here and decompressing. We had a great feast. Brother commented today on how everybody pitched in and helped, and that really, really made a great feast. That's just what we were hoping we'd see, and there was a need, there was somebody there, and that really says it all. While still fresh in your mind, you should be preparing for next year. Here are a couple things you might want to remember to improve upon next year. If you didn't plan your time off well enough this year, make sure you make some changes for next year. Block off a week and a half instead of cutting it short. Allow for some travel time as well as for some calendar adjustments, because as we know, calendar isn't very certain anymore. The new moon, I guess, for Tabernacle is going to be another one of these, so make preparation. If you ran out of money at the end of the feast, save even better for next year. Remember the second tithe. Do without here and there during the year. Save that money. Take on an extra job. Have a garage sale. Save the money. It can be done. Be just judicious when you get there, too, and, you know, make it last. There was a family there that hadn't worked. He hadn't worked for 9 months, and yet he was there. It was his first time, and he was there. That takes a little dedication, something that we can all learn from. Consider the things that you brought that you didn't need and the things you needed but didn't bring. And I would suggest you make a permanent feast checklist, and you modify it each year to suit whatever circumstance. Because we all left things, forgot things in the flurry of the moment, you know, packing everything up. Was your vehicle adequate enough? Was it too large, too small? Learn from this year and you'll enjoy the feast much better next year. I was given the following about the English language from Brother Ellis Wiley at the feast after my message on Bible study. It says, the English language. Have you ever wondered why foreigners have trouble with the English language? Let's face it. English is a crazy language. There is no egg and eggplant, no ham and hamburger, and neither pine nor apple in the pineapple. English muffins were not invented in England. French fries were not invented in France. We sometimes take English for granted, but if we examine its paradoxes, we find that quicksand takes you down slowly, boxing rings are square, and a guinea pig is neither from Guinea nor is it a pig. If writers write, how come fingers don't fing? If the plural of tooth is teeth, shouldn't the plural of phone booth be phone beeth? If a teacher taught, why didn't the preacher prot? If a vegetarian eats vegetables, what does a humanitarian eat? Why do people recite at a play, yet play at a recital? Park on driveways and drive on parkways. You have to marvel at the unique lunacy of a language where a house can burn up as it also burns down, and in which you fill in a form by filling it out. English was invented by people, not computers, and it reflects the creativity of the human race, which of course isn't a race at all. That is why when the stars are out, they're visible, but when the lights are out, they're invisible. And why it is when I wind up my watch, it starts, but when I wind up this observation, it ends. I'm convinced that English is the most confusing language ever invented. It's also the most rich, and I guess that's why. It borrows from so many different languages. What about Hebrew, the language of the scriptures? What about that? It's the language of biblical truth. We know that. So what can it tell us that we could understand better about the Bible? Well, we know that originally there was one language on earth. Genesis tells us that. There was only one language. Hebrew is the language of Yahweh's chosen people. Hebrew is the language of the Old Testament. I understand that Hebrew, being a pure language, as the Bible says, has no profanity in it. Zephaniah chapter 3 and verse 9 indicates that Hebrew also may be the language of the millennium. Let's turn there a minute. I had this question posed at the feast. And it says, Zephaniah 3:9, for then will I turn to the people a pure language, that they may all call upon the name of Yahweh to serve him with one consent. What language is that? Well, if we turn to Isaiah chapter 19, let's look at something interesting here. Isaiah 19 and verse 18. In that day, speaking of the coming kingdom, shall five cities in the land of Egypt speak the language of Canaan and swear to Yahweh of hosts. What was the language of Canaan? Well, in the 8th century, before our common era, it was Hebrew. The Hebrews were there. So we find that in the millennium, there's going to be speaking a language of Canaan. From a study of world history, Hebrew is the oldest of all languages. Although they always say, you know, Sanskrit and all of this, Indo-European, that's just a way to avoid anything connoting what they believe was Jews. But all the ancient cuneiforms and all of that show to an early Hebrew in the different forms and different figures that we see there. Yahweh spoke to Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden in Genesis 1:29. He said, "Behold, I have given you every herb bearing seed which is upon the face of the earth, and every tree in which is the fruit of a tree yielding seed. To you it shall be for meat." What language was he speaking to them in? After many generations, there was only one language, we read. Genesis 11:1. So what about this language? What were they communicating in? Let's try to understand why Yahweh communicates to man. In what language? Perhaps his own language. If you look at the Hebrew and the Hebrew people, they are very energetic people. Robust. Pharaoh found that out, didn't he? When all the slaves kept multiplying and multiplying, and pretty soon they're going to overtake the Egyptians. They were very active people. Their language is very active. It's full of life. These were primarily outdoor people, agrarian, farmers, fishermen, tradesmen, who lived life to the full. For them, truth was not so much an idea to be contemplated as an experience to be lived. They lived their belief. And this is the lesson we get right out of the Bible, through the Hebrew tongue. The biblical writers often use vocabulary which is very colorful, dynamic, action-centered. The people, the Hebrews, were mainly a doing and a feeling people. And their language is filled with things like overstatements, hyperbole they call it. Overkill, you might say. The Psalms have a lot of that in it, David wrote. The Hebrews often refer to Yahweh by human traits, human attributes. Psalm 89 talks about Yahweh's strong arm and his strong hand doing something. Job 38, I mean, when he talks about, remember after when the whole thing was over with Job, and Yahweh sits him down and says, "Okay, let me have a little chat with you, because I don't think you quite understand me yet, and I don't think you really realize who and what I am." So in Job 38, Yahweh answers Job out of the whirlwind and says, "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? What do you know? What do you know, O Job? Gird up your loins like a man, for I will demand of you and answer you me. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare it if you have understanding." Now, we get a very colorful picture here. Who has laid the measures thereof, if you know? Or who has stretched the line upon it? We almost get a picture of a construction worker, you know, putting out his lines, his to make everything square, his levels and all of that, you know, and his protractors and drawing everything out. He says, "Where were you when I did all this? Whereupon are the foundations thereof fastened? Or who laid the cornerstone thereof?" More very picturesque language. We can see it in our mind's eye. He says, "When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of Elohim shouted for joy. Or who shut up the seas with doors when it brake forth as if it had issued out of the womb? When I made the cloud the garment thereof, and thick darkness and swaddling band for it." Just very visual language. That's Hebrew. Very descriptive language. Hebrew is also a language of emotion. The holy days described in the Bible reveal an emphasis on the release of motion, on joy, especially joy. And they were all, virtually, except for a couple, celebrated that way. Very joyful, fun times, time to get together and honor Yahweh. And the weekly Sabbath. Turn to Isaiah chapter 58. A time of rejoicing as Yahweh is our creator, so we come before him. Isaiah 58 and verse 13. I want to read a couple verses here. If you turn away your foot from the Sabbath, from doing your pleasure on my holy day, and call the Sabbath a delight, the holy of Yahweh, honorable, and shall honor him, not doing your own ways, nor finding your own pleasure, nor speaking your own words, then shall you delight yourself in Yahweh. So the Sabbath is a time of delight. And I will cause you to ride upon the high places of the earth. More descriptive, powerful language. And feed you with the heritage of Jacob your father, for the mouth of Yahweh has spoken it. It's a language that really expresses how people feel. I almost think it's almost like an artistic language. A lot of emotion involved. The entire annual calendar of feasts shows the Hebrews were not afraid to release their emotions. And I think we had a good time as well, just recently. Yahweh was the one that they were worshiping. They were never half-hearted about it. They were into it full speed. The Hebrews knew the wisdom of learning and what it meant to trust in matters they could not fully understand. They didn't always try to reconcile discrepancies. You know, we try to get down to the nitty-gritty. I guess that's just part of the scientific world we come from. You know, we see a little bit of a problem here, and how come that doesn't square with this? And this is not making any sense with this. And they weren't as concerned about that. They believed that Yahweh ultimately was greater than the human attempt at systematizing truth. Walk in the truth. Live the truth. That was the important thing. Don't worry about the nitty-gritty little pity things that we just can't understand anyway and never will until Yahshua comes. There was a higher priority than rationalizing, analyzing, always trying to find everything to our understanding. We're not going to do it because we're living a couple generations of languages away from the truth. So not only time has made a difference, but the languages itself. Greek is a language of science and reasoning. Hebrew is a language of feeling and doing. That is one reason we have such a difficult time with the New Testament, especially when it's, you know, again, coming from different languages. And here we get to try to go back to the Greek. We still aren't back to the pure understanding of the Hebrew because we don't have the Hebrew text. And it sometimes seems out of sync with the Old Testament. They are different in the way they communicate. The new, of course, being filtered through a Greek. Try to take an artistic approach and filter it through science. That's like when people go into an art museum and say, look at this picture. There's no sense to it. The artist says, no, there's not supposed to be any sense to it. You're supposed to feel it. You're supposed to feel that picture. Can't you feel it? You know? The guy goes shaking his head. That's the stupidest picture I ever saw because he's trying to make sense of it, you see? The same kind of idea. Not quite that dramatic, but it's a language of feeling. Some would define religion as a system of ethics, an ideology, or a creed. To a Hebrew, it is none of these. They're misleading to him or inaccurate. A Hebrew understands his daily life of faith in terms of a journey, in terms of a pilgrimage. In fact, you look in the New Testament, what are the people asking? What do you call yourselves? I say the people in the New Testament were called people of the way. They were on a journey. They were walking. It's a walk. And that really describes our faith. It's a walk. It's not just a talk. It's an actual, like the Hebrews, they would actually get involved in motion, in walking, in doing, following what it says. Even before the flood, people such as Enoch and Noah, we see, walked with Yahweh. That's a term the Hebrew uses a lot. Genesis 5:24, 6:9. If a person knows Yahweh, he is daily at Yahweh's disposal, walking, following his guide. Ceremonialism and ritual, they don't meet those requirements as a walk does. Let's turn to Isaiah chapter 1. They were there to teach a lesson, to teach you how to walk better. That's what those rituals, all that ceremony was there intended to do. That wasn't the end result. That was just a means to something better, to teach you how to walk in a much better way. Isaiah chapter 1, verse 11. To what purpose is the multitude of your sacrifices unto me, says Yahweh? I am full of the burnt offerings of rams, the fat of fed beasts, and I delight not in the blood of bullocks or of lambs or of he-goats. When you come to appear before me, who has required this at your hand to tread my courts? Bring no more vain oblations. Apparently, that was a sum and substance of too many. They thought, well, I gave them the offering, that was enough. Kind of like people do today. I showed up, I sat in the pew for 10 minutes, I fulfilled my religious obligation for a week. Yahweh says, that's not it. Bring no more vain oblations. Incense is an abomination unto me. The new moons, the Sabbaths, the calling of assemblies, I cannot away with. It is iniquity, even the solemn meeting. Why? Next verse, your new moons and your appointed feasts. They were doing it their way. My soul hates. They are a trouble unto me. I am weary to bear them. And when you spread forth your hands, I will hide my eyes from you. Yea, when you make your prayers, I will not hear. Your hands are full of blood. Wash you, make you clean. Put away the evil of your doings from before my eyes. Cease to do evil. Learn to do well. Seek judgment. Relieve the oppressed. Judge the fatherless. Plead for the widows. Notice verse 17. These are active action verbs. Active. Learn. Seek. Relieve. Judge. Plead. See, he wants action. He wants it expressed in our lives. Come now, let us reason together. Another active verb. That's what Yahweh is looking for. I'd like to turn now to Amos chapter 5, verse 21. I hate, I despise your feast days. I will not smell in your solemn assemblies. Though you offer me burnt offerings and your meat offerings, I will not accept them. Neither will I regard the peace offerings of your fat beasts. Take away from me the noise of your songs, for I will not hear the melody of your viols. But let judgment run down as waters and righteousness as a mighty stream. Again, they were off track. They weren't doing as he had commanded them spiritually to understand. They were off track. But those who act justly, love mercy, walk humbly with Yahweh, do please him, according to Micah 6:8. Well, the essence of religion, the essence of really what we're doing here, is all about relationship, isn't it? It's all about relationship. It's walking with Yahweh in his path of wisdom and righteousness and a way of service to others. In Yahshua's Sermon on the Mount, he uses this idea to teach it really about the two ways. In Matthew chapter 7, you've got the broad way. Everybody's on the broad way. It's easy. We're coming back from the feast, and the first hour, we went through some mountainous country that was unbelievable. Twists and turns and hairpins and watching the tail end of our car all of a sudden appear before us. And man, where are we going to get out of this? You know, and finally, we got out of it. But it was a beautiful drive, and I'm glad we did it in the daytime. Some of you had to do it at night. And I feel for that, but it's a beautiful country. Matthew 7:13, enter ye in at the straight gate, for wide is the gate, and broad is the way that leads to destruction, and many there be which go in thereat. Then he says, because straight, that's an old English word for narrow, is the gate, and narrow is the way which leads unto life, and few there be that find it. Two different ways. Again, it's couched in the words for movement, a path, a travel. So he says there's two ways. Even Yahshua uses the same Hebrew idea of going, moving from one place to another, you know, from leaving one place and moving on into something better. And he even said, I am the way. Again, using it again, John 14:6. So this idea of traveling to one or the other is intrinsic in the Hebrew. What about the Hebrew itself? Noah Webster, from whom we get the Webster's Dictionary, he traced numerous English words back to the Hebrew language. His etymologies were discredited for about 200 years. They were full of English words traced back to Hebrew, to Semitic sources. Or he actually used Shemite sources, which is more correct. At the time of the American Revolution, interest in Hebrew was so widespread that certain members of Congress proposed that the use of English be formally prohibited in the United States and Hebrew substituted for it. Can you imagine? In colonial America, numerous colleges and universities were established under the auspices of various Protestant, mostly Calvinistic, sects. Harvard, Yale, William and Mary, Rutgers, Princeton, Brown, King's College, which became Columbia, Johns Hopkins, Dartmouth, all of these started out as religious schools. And what did they do? Mainly to teach about the Bible and Hebrew. In fact, a major function of many of these was to graduate ministers to go out and teach Scripture. So the Bible played a central role. Try to bring the Bible in now to those colleges and see what would happen. It was the curriculum. With both Hebrew and the Bible, required courses. All Harvard undergraduates, except freshmen, were required to study Hebrew. Harvard assumed that no one could be considered truly educated unless he could read the Bible in the original language. Many of these colleges adopted some Hebrew word or phrase as part of their official emblem. One day we were in Walmart, and there was a sweatshirt there, had the Harvard seal on it. It's got Hebrew on it. Look at it sometime. Yeah. Hebrew language in the 18th century was very, very important to people. In fact, several students at Yale delivered their commencement addresses in the Hebrew. It was the language that Yahweh communicated to Adam in, which I'm going to demonstrate, and the language used by the heavenly messengers when they spoke to people here on earth. Why is it that whenever celestial beings came to mankind, they came to those that spoke Hebrew? They didn't go to the Muslims. Well, there wasn't any back then, but they hadn't invented that religion yet. Or they didn't go to the Greeks. They didn't go to the Romans who spoke Latin. They always came to the Hebrews. Let's turn to Acts chapter 26 and see what language Yahshua spoke to Paul in when he communicated there in Acts 26 and verse 14 after he was knocked down, or before, while he was being knocked down on the road. Got his attention. Acts 26, 14. When we were all fallen to the earth, I heard a voice saying unto me and saying in the Hebrew tongue, Shaul, Shaul, why persecutest thou me? It is hard for you to kick against the goads. Why are you rebelling? Why are you fighting it? You're hurting your own self, he's saying. And he said, who art thou, master? And he said, I am Yahshua, whom you persecute. Spoke to him in the Hebrew tongue. Hebrew tongue. Now, think about this for a minute. If he were the champion of the Christian Greek religion, which is basically what it is, why didn't he speak to the risen Messiah in Greek? And why didn't Yahshua speak to him in Greek? We've got a whole new system now. We've got the New Testament, right? We're changing everything now. I don't think so. Girdleston's Old Testament synonym says, the Hebrew language, though poor in some respects, that is, in tenses, is rich in others. And probably no better language could have been selected for the purpose of preparing the way of Messiah. He points out the richness of the Hebrew language. He gives examples. He gives seven Hebrew words for black. That'd be nice to have some, you know, distinctions there, because all we have is black and gray, right? What is in between? They've got lots of different varieties to describe black. In fact, actually used in the King James. Eight words translated axe, A-X-E. 12 words for beauty, 12 for body, 14 for dark, 18 are rendered fear, 22 for branch, 26 for cover, 42 for cut, 60 for break, 66 for bring, and 74 are rendered take. Interesting, isn't it? When you try to go into a Strong's Concordance and decipher some finite meanings, one guy said it's like taking a chainsaw to butter. It's a lot divided, a lot more fine than I think, we realize that language. Strong's did the best he could, and he does pretty well on most things, but we know he's not good on the name, and we know that there are other, you know, Jacenius's and other word lexicons that help us much better. In reading our English translation, we are missing much of the exactness and the correctness of the original language. And of course, something is always lost in translation, isn't it? You can't go from one language to another without losing something. In reading our English translations, we don't always pick up on those nuances that the original language had, which the translators were not careful enough to transmit the fine distinctions of. As every lawyer knows, fine distinctions sometimes make all the difference. We're trying to decipher a word. For example, look at the third commandment. You shall not take the name of Yahweh your Elohim in vain. Most people think this is cussing on the golf course. Well, vain is the Hebrew shah, S-H-A-W, from the root show. And it has the basic meaning of deception or lying. The effect of making something desolate and useless. The New Strong's Expanded Concordance says it figuratively means idolatry. Isn't substituting his name with a heathen mighty one idolatry? Sure it is. You're not worshiping him anymore. The identity has been changed. A lying deception that causes his true name to become desolate and useless. That's what that third commandment is talking about. Where has his name been for the past 2,000 years? Where'd it go? Desolate. Virtually unknown by the world. Well, scholarship is finally bringing it back, thank goodness. Because they would sound ridiculous using names with J's in them when there was no J. And hasn't been until before the time of Columbus. So, I mean, they have to admit it's right. Yahweh is known as the Mighty One of Israel in the Old Testament. In the New Testament, the saints or believers are known as what? Israel of Yahweh. Galatians 6:16. His name has profound and deep meaning, which distinguishes true worship from the false. True worship from the false. And if we go to the Hebrew, the original language, we can get a lot clearer understanding of the original intent. In fact, the first spoken command given to mankind is in Genesis 1:28. He told Adam and Eve not to eat of the forbidden fruit. And, no, I'm sorry, that's in 2:16. The first command is in 1:28. 2:16 is about the forbidden fruit. And then, tree of knowledge and good and evil. He spoke to them in chapter 3, and they understood, and they answered him. And they carried on a conversation back and forth. What language was it? Well, if you go to Genesis 14, verse 13, it identifies Abraham as what? A Hebrew. Hebrews spoke what? Greek? Oh. Their name says it all. They spoke the Hebrew tongue. Yahweh communicated with Adam and Eve in Hebrew, which is the language of celestial beings and would logically be the original Hebrew tongue, then. How can we know? Because no other tongue is mentioned in the scriptures for the earliest biblical communication. It's the language of the oldest manuscripts and is the language specifically mentioned when people were spoken to from on high in both Old and New Testaments. Obviously, speaking Hebrew, Adam named the birds and beasts as Yahweh brought them to him, gave him a name that reflected his Hebrew tongue. We look at the people's names in the Old Testament. They're all Hebrew. At the feast, I don't know if any of you saw that Alvin York Memorial, the most decorated serviceman in World War I. He had 10 kids, and he named them all after famous Americans. I thought that was interesting. How would you like to be named Sam Houston or, Grover Cleveland? Here, Grover, come over here, But he was so patriotic. Well, in Hebrew, we know that names mean something. Adam means ruddy. Eve, Hava, means life or life spring. The Bible says she is the mother of all living. When people come along and say, oh, I believe there was another race back then, they're defying what the Hebrew says. She is, and her name says, the mother of all living. Just look at the names of other Old Testament personalities. You'll see they have Hebrew meanings that seem to reflect their personality very well. Genesis 10 tells of Nimrod, the son of Cush, the son of Ham, who began his kingdom in Babel, in the land of Shinar, in verse 10. This incident is key to what happened, because we know that all the languages were confused. And people say, well, how do you know it was Hebrew? There's all these languages, and they were all confused. Well, the present world population is descended from only three sons of Noah, right? Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Everybody else was killed. Shem, Ham, and Japheth. So it's recognized that Nimrod was instrumental in getting the people together to build a tower, and which was the centerpiece of the city. The families of Ham and Japheth settled in the plains and the seacoasts. The descendants of Shem, where we get the word name, did not dwell in the plains of Shinar. They went to the mountains, the hill country of Mesha. It says in Genesis 10:30, and their dwelling was from Mesha as you go unto Sephar, a mount of the east. So the Shemites stayed in the high country, much as did Abraham later on. Genesis chapter 13. They weren't in the area of the Tower of Babel, which means what? Would their language need to change? They weren't there. He confounded the people who were working on that tower and changed their languages. So they stayed in the high country. This was the construction of the Tower of Babel was the project of the sons of Ham and Japheth under the directions of Nimrod, and it was to be a monument to man. Around the tower, the city of Babylon was planned in order to establish their fame independent of Yahweh. And this was a way, you go down the highway and you see a big building sticking way up there, it's kind of a drawing point, Must be a big city coming up. So that's what they were looking for, something to bring people in. Shem means name, and through Shem, his descendants, the good seed, began and spread. And so we have the patriarchs from that. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. He didn't join with the peoples in Shinar, the plains of Shinar. These were righteous people. They wouldn't rebel against Yahweh anyway, get involved in that crazy tower he's trying to build. They knew that was wrong. That was idolatry. Well, the Shemites were even persecuted by Nimrod, and so they stayed apart, according to a book by Bishik, called Adam and His Kin. The lineage of Shem is the key, really, showing that Hebrew is the heavenly language, because it was the Shemites who continued pure in their worship, continued pure in the Hebrew language. In the New Bible Dictionary, J.D. Douglas says, Hebrew belongs to the Western group of Semitic languages. In fact, he says the word Shemite or Semite is formed from the name Shem, Noah's eldest son. In his blessing on Shem, Noah called Yahweh the Elohim of Shem. So that is the pure worship. And Yahweh said he would dwell in the, and said Yahweh would dwell in the tents of Shem. Shem, whose native tongue was Hebrew, lived 98 years during his great grandfather Methuselah's time. Have you ever wondered why Methuselah lived so long, 969 years? He tied all these generations together. These were a family. The family. Think about this. Remember this. Methuselah, get this right. Shem lived 98 years during his great-grandfather's Methuselah's time. So we're going backwards now. Remember, the earth was of one language. Shem had nearly 100 years to carry on a discourse and receive instruction from his great-grandfather. 100 years. You think one was speaking Latin, another speaking Hebrew? I don't think so. Methuselah lived and shared 243 years with Adam, and another 600 years with Noah. Noah lived, I almost have to have this drawn out on a chart, Noah lived 350 years after the flood and died only 2 years before the birth of Abraham. Noah's son Shem lived until Abraham was 150 years old, and Isaac was then 50 years of age. What's the key here? Here is a family of which the progenitor, Adam, spoke Hebrew with Yahweh, his creator, and his descendants lived speaking the same language. Methuselah, the same language, he passes that language on to his offspring. Families always speak the same language, right? So we have here then, in Genesis 10:21, more confirmation. Genesis 10:21. We have confirmation that Shem is the father of all the children of Eber. And of course, Eber is where we get the word Hebrew. People of the name. 10:21, Shemites. Unto Shem also the father of all the children of Eber, the brother of Japheth, the elder, even to him were children born. Then it gives the genealogy there. So Shem is the father of the children of all the children of Eber. Eber, we get the word Hebrew from. NIV note on Genesis 10:21 confirms it. Companion note confirms it as well. In Genesis 14:12, we learn that Abraham is referred to as a Hebrew, don't we? He's called a Hebrew. Genesis 14:12 and 13. All you have to do is study the names of people and places in the book of Genesis to acknowledge that these are Hebrew names. These are Hebrew people speaking Hebrew. And because children learn the language of their parents and their parents and their parents, even though they might be even reared in a foreign country, this was not a big place. It was all, you know, pretty concentrated. You go over there and you realize it's kind of like Europe, you know, you go from one nation to another. The same distance that we went to the feast. You know, you just pass through three different nations there because they're smaller and they're concentrated. So it's not unusual for people to cluster together in a foreign place, and obviously they did too because of the difficulties of the language. We find the same thing here in this country. You have the French Quarter, you have the Chinese, Little China, you know, and where is it? Los Angeles and Little Italy and Germantown, and these people settled in areas because they were common with the people and their language. So they all kind of came together. And this was true of the biblical Hebrews. In Genesis chapter 12, the Bible focuses upon Adam and his descendants, Isaac and Jacob. I'm sorry, Abraham. Abraham and his descendants, not Adam, of course, was way back. So, we put it all together and we see that Shem lived 98 years before the flood, 502 years after the flood, and 75 years after Abraham entered Canaan. All of these men were and shared a special relationship with Yahweh. And they spoke the same language that their fathers, great-grandfathers, great-great-grandfathers also spoke. We know the Ten Commandments were written with the finger of Elohim on two tables of stone and then given to Moses. They were written, obviously, in the Hebrew tongue, the only language that Yahweh ever communicated with people through. Israel stood before Mount Sinai and listened as Yahweh spoke to them. They understood it, they heard it, but they were afraid. It was loud. It was very moving, but very loud. And everything shook. When Yahweh speaks, everything shakes. Moses wrote the first five books of the Bible in Hebrew because this was what he was speaking, obviously. And this helped unify the Israelites. Also established Hebrew as the language of the temple and worship. Sephardi Hebrew was more the original language. Ashkenazi, which was influenced by the Germanic up in Europe, came a little later. Thus, we have people writing Yahweh's name with a V instead of a W. W is older. The Waw didn't have a V sound. That was Ashkenazi. That's Germanic influence. The Sephardic is anchored to the Masoretic vowel pointing. And by the way, it's the Jews in Spain that basically spoke the Ashkenazi. I'm sorry, the Sephardic. The other Jews that went up into Germany spoke the other, Ashkenazi. But the Sephardic is more biblical. And so we base our understanding of Yahweh's name and other things on that Hebrew. The Sephardic Hebrew is the language of the temple and has been preserved for us by the Yemenites, Yemenite Jews, and Spanish Jews. Even today, young children in Israel learn to write and speak Hebrew no matter what country that they may have come from. So the language, and it's not the same, and I asked, it's not the same as biblical Hebrew, but it's, you know, it's understandable. I asked the Steve there at the feast, the Greek, is Greek today the same as biblical Greek? He said, no, it's not. And I guess I said, you can understand it if you read it. He said, well, I can kind of, but it's not the same. I've often wondered that, you know. Languages change, and with time. And the same with biblical Hebrew as opposed to Hebrew spoken today. It's not the same. But it's close. I mean, you can still make it out in many respects. The Old Testament was handed down from Hebrew originals, we understand, with, scholars say some, of course they say exceptions, but Nehemiah 8:8, the people were instructed in the law. Likely it was an Aramaic, perhaps paraphrase, the language of the Babylonian captivity, because as they went into other languages, other areas, the language started to modify a little, as it does in this country. You go from one part of the country to the other, you go down into the Bayou country, and some of the words they say don't make a lot of sense to us. We're just not used to it. It's a dialect because of French influence and other things, but you go to a different part of the country and they're going to speak a different type of dialect. You put a New Yorker down there with somebody from, you know, the Cajun country, and it'll be quite a thing to see him try to communicate. When I was Marge and I took a trip to New York one time, and she could translate the policeman's English there in New York City. I couldn't understand what he was saying. He talked so fast and used this brogue, you know, I couldn't pick up on it. She could translate it just like that. But that's the way it is when you go from one part to another. And you can imagine the difference. You go from one country to another and how the influence is going to be there from other languages. They're going to pick up things. Some of the people of the world don't like the fact that so many anglicized words are entering their language from our country because we're over there influencing them and they're sending up, you know, this entertainment that we do over here and everything else. So it's a natural progression and influence. So no wonder we sometimes have problems with the language. Here we are trying to decipher an ancient custom through a modern language that's a mixture of many, many other languages. It's been filtered through maybe two or three other languages, through the Septuagint maybe, and then the Latin, and then we get it in English. No wonder there's some problems. I mean, just think about it. So that's why we always try to go back to the original as close as we can get to it, because that's where you're going to find the truth. The name Hebrew, as I said, derives from Eber, the great grandson of Shem. Eber was a Hebrew, and he spoke Hebrew, and so did his great-grandfather Shem. And there is where we get the language and the name, and why, if we go back, as we showed, go back into the history, why it started out in Hebrew and was carried on down through a family, basically a family relationship. It's pretty amazing. Yahweh preserved it that well. In examining the New Testament, we find again that when one was spoken to from the heavens, it was always in the Hebrew. In chapter 1 of Luke, the priest Zechariah was performing his duties in the temple. The angel of Yahweh appeared to him and related how Elizabeth was soon to have a son. He'd be called John. Well, that's not what he's... Elkanah is really what his name was. Well, certainly a priest of the course of Abia would be addressed in his native Hebrew, would he not? Sure he would. Later we learn that the Virgin Miriam was also visited by Gabriel, who proclaimed the soon coming birth of Yahshua. In what language? Well, she was a Jew. She spoke Hebrew. I don't think she knew Greek. I don't think she was that educated. Joseph was descended from the lineage of King David, tribe of Judah. We know they spoke Hebrew. In chapter 2 of Luke, we read that the Judean shepherds watching their flocks by night, when the celestial being came to them announcing the birth of Yahshua. What language do you think it was? These were Hebrews. But you see, the tie was always there, the tie. In Matthew chapter 3, verse 17, is the baptism of Yahshua the Messiah. A voice came from heaven declaring, "This was my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased." Obviously, in the Hebrew. In Luke chapter 4, Matthew chapter 4 as well, is the account of Satan, the fallen angel, speaking with the Hebrew Yahshua, obviously in Hebrew. In Acts chapter 9, we find that Paul was reiterating his experience there with being knocked down. Let's look at Acts chapter 9. Knocked down on the road. Chapter 26, as he's reiterating this to King Agrippa, 26 verse 12. "Whereupon, as I went to Damascus with authority and commission from the chief priests at midday, O king, I saw in the way a light from heaven above, the brightness of the sun shining round about me and them which journeyed with us. And when we were all fallen to the earth, I heard a voice speaking unto me and saying in the Hebrew tongue, Shaul, Shaul, why persecute thou me?" We reviewed that part. Verse 16 says, "But rise and stand upon your feet, for I have appeared unto you for this purpose, to make you a minister and witness both of these things which you have seen and the things in which I will appear unto you. Deliver thee from the people and from the Gentiles unto whom now I send you, to open their eyes and to learn, to turn them from darkness unto light, and from the power of Satan unto Elohim, that they might receive forgiveness of sins and inheritance among them which are sanctified by faith which is in me." Inheritance. Inheritance from who? The promise was only given to Israel. We're to receive an inheritance, a promised blessing that was laid out by Yahweh in his word to the people of Israel. And that is all, not to anybody else. So we find that Yahweh is very clear that he passes on truth from one generation to another, and that truth is based in the original people that he gave his word to, the Hebrew-speaking people. If we want to learn the truth, we got to go back to how he communicated, and then we'll know, and then we'll see. And I sure wish someday we're going to find that Hebrew New Testament, because it's going to answer all those questions. Maybe in our lifetime, maybe not. But if we could ever do it, we would have a lot of contradictions or alleged contradictions suddenly disappear, because everything will make sense. It won't be filtered through so many different ways. We can pray to Yahweh in any language, and he's going to understand us, because he's not limited, of course, to one language. He understands all human speech. I mean, actually, he gave us this language in so many ways. When the languages were confounded, of course, it's modified and changed through the years. But he says in Revelation 2:23, "I am he which searches the reins and the hearts." But what else does he say? "Call on my name. Call on my name." the name that he gave in the Hebrew tongue. He said in Luke 16:15, unto them, you are they which justify yourselves before men, but Yahweh knows your hearts. And that is what the Hebrew language spoke to. It spoke to the heart, not so much to the reason of the brain, but to the heart. And it's a language you can feel. It's very profound in that way. A language of emotion. Paul tells us the whole family of heaven and earth is named after Yahweh in Ephesians chapter 3 and verse 14. I want to close with that. Ephesians 3:14. For this cause I bow my knees unto the Father of our Master Yahshua the Messiah, of whom the whole family in heaven and earth is named. The Master, Yahshua the Messiah. How can it be named in a Latinized Greek name if the whole family in heaven and earth is named after him? It would have to be in a Hebrew tongue and in a Hebrew name. It's just as clear that he would grant you according to the riches of his glory to be strengthened with the might of his spirit in the inner man, that Messiah may dwell in your hearts by faith, that you being rooted and grounded in love may be able to comprehend with all saints what is the breadth and length and depth and height, to know the love of Messiah which passes knowledge, that you might be filled with all the fullness of Elohim. A love and a desire that passes knowledge, that passes a scientific look. It's in the heart. And I believe of all the strength of this language, that's what it's all about. A language that speaks to the heart. May Yahweh bless you.